Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Blake. Another foul on Ward. This third for setting a screen.
He starts a physical play, although George Taylor just got caught with a moving screen.
Pick and roll. And a foul. Offensive foul coming up. Dan Valentine's getting it right there.
Mizzo dying for a moving screen.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another edition of the Moving Screen Podcast, your favorite podcast on Michigan and Michigan State basketball, as well as the Big Ten. I'm Brendan Quinn with The Athletic. I'm here with Dylan Burkhart of umhoops.com. Dylan, how we doing, man? Are you in the igloo? Are you ready for this week? It's bad, man. This is the nightmare of nightmares for mid-Big Ten's travel schedule season.
This is probably every mid-Big Ten travel season. I don't know if there's ever a year when it's warm in late January, early February.
Dude, they're talking about like minus 40 in certain cities in the Big Ten. Chicago.
Who doesn't want to visit Iowa City when it's 20 below?
Oh, my God.
I feel like that's what everyone's here for, right?
Well, it's Monday morning just before 10 a.m. The snow is now coming down in Ann Arbor, according to the window here. Dylan, how's it down there? Are you guys bracing yet?
They say the big freeze is coming on Wednesday. No snow right
no
now.
No snow?
All right.
Oh, you're lucky dog. We're supposed to get like 4 to 6 or 8 inches or something like that. I don't know. But it was really delightful driving around Indiana for the weekend through this weather. I was in Bloomington on a Friday night. I was in West Lafayette on Sunday. A split for the teams of this podcast, Michigan with a good win. We'll get into that in a little bit. But Michigan State, probably more notably with its first loss in Big Ten play, makes the standing certainly look a little bit more interesting for a number of reasons, I think. I think Purdue winning that game kind of slides them into that. They're, what, 8-2 or something? Am I off on that?
7-2.
7-2, so... There's just a little bit, you know, before all season it's been Michigan State, gap, everyone else. And that gap is maybe getting a little tighter.
Purdue is done playing Michigan or Michigan State.
Yeah.
So they have the back door in the conference title race is open.
Sure. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They have 6 remaining road games as though... does Michigan, right? And Michigan mm-hmm. State in the advantageous position of only having 4 remaining road games. So
if you look at Purdue's schedule, they are at least 50. The lowest chance they have to win is 49% per KenPom in any remaining game, and that's at Nebraska, who just lost Isaac Copeland. So mm-hmm. I don't know if they're really a team that's going to just run through the second half of the schedule, but I think they'll be in the picture now for a while because there's not – doesn't look that imposing if you look closely at their schedule.
No, and we'll probably get into Purdue a little bit in the back end of the show in the power rankings part. But, you know, it's just worth noting just because of this conversation here, Purdue gets Penn State twice, Minnesota twice. They don't have Rutgers. They do. They have Illinois once at home. So you're right. You know, it's basically if they can steal some wins. You know, KenPom has them projected to finish 15-5 in the league. Well, if they pull that off, that they're certainly in the conversation, kind of depending on what happens with Michigan and Michigan State. But let's get into the game yesterday. It was rocking and rolling at Mackey Arena. Just a great, great environment. It's such a great place to see a game. The place was packed 10 minutes before tip-off, ready to roll. And Purdue jumped on them. I thought Michigan State came out, I don't know, flat's the right word. They weren't quite ready, I think, to match Purdue's intensity and match their balance, because that was the biggest part of the first half, is that it was not Carson Edwards chucking shots and trying to be the be-all, end-all. They were balanced. They got buckets all over the place. They got bench scoring. It was just a really... It looked like the complete opposite of what was seen in East Lansing, essentially, 3 weeks earlier.
Did you expect that kind of a performance? Did you think, like, what did you kind of, what was your expectation going into the game?
I thought this was going to probably be the L for State. They were kind of due for a game where maybe they didn't have their legs underneath them to be running and gunning, and you know, the narrative of fatigue and stuff like that is already, you know, very much kind of saturated this storyline of this game, and I'm not quite buying that, because I was in the locker room with every other reporter when Aaron Henry said, quote, it wasn't fatigue, and Cassius Winston said, no, it wasn't fatigue, you know, we were ready to go, blah, blah, blah. And it's fine to say that, but, I mean, as anyone who's watched Michigan State play every game, they were not running the floor the same way in the first half. They weren't closing out the same way in the first half that they have defensively. Their bigs weren't getting out. And actually, Purdue kind of stretched them a little bit and kind of got Nick Ward and Xavier Tillman to even probably go out a little bit further than they are used to. And that the residuals of that tweak kind of threw things off a little bit. But look, I mean, Purdue played really well. And Michigan State didn't play well. And that was kind of – that was going to happen at some point. And that's pretty much the read. I don't think there's any grand – takeaways of, man, major issues, you know, that Michigan State has. I think this thing was kind of brewing for a little bit.
Yeah, so I have a couple thoughts on this one. The first thing is that Michigan State's defense is very much inside out, and Purdue is very much an outside-in team. Purdue shoots more threes than anyone in the Big Ten. Michigan State has kind of gotten by allowing three-point attempts, but a low percentage on those shots. And depending on who you talk to, you can say that there's a statistical argument that the three-point accuracy is fairly random, and three-point volume is what the defense has more control over.
Sure.
This was some regression to the mean there for Michigan State, because Purdue shot 43% from three and made 12 threes.
Right, and you get killed when a guy like Aaron Wheeler goes 3-for-3, because you're not game-planning for that at all. He came into the game, I think, with only like 16 made threes on the season, and then he goes 3-for-3. Like, that's the one where the coach, you know, that's when the staff is in the room after the game looking at each other saying, you know, freaking Aaron Wheeler, are you kidding me? Of all the things you plan for, that's just not there.
Yeah, and the way Michigan State's defense is designed, you're going to give that up, because right, you're going to hold right a team to 33% two-point. It's really hard to win a game when you make one out of every three shots inside the arc.
Right.
So I think that's an interesting to look at. And I think when Michigan State's defense has cracked over the last year and a half or so, it's usually a team that can spread the floor and pull the bigs away from the basket a little bit and beat them outside in. So that's the one point that I would probably look at first with this game. And that's definitely what happened in the first half. And then the second half was kind of just a completely different game, where Purdue stopped making threes, couldn't score inside, and then Michigan State came all the way back. What do you think that comeback says about, I guess, this team? And I guess, is that kind of fool's gold? Is that something you buy into?
No, I think
similar to the Kansas game, right?
I think it said a lot about Cassius Winston. I think it said that this team, you know, people can forget about that Northwestern game last year when they were down 27 or whatever. Like, point being, when you have it in your pocket that you can do it or that it can be done, it's a little bit easier to not fold up the tent, you know, and go home. A couple guys mentioned that in the locker room. Like Nick Ward said, you know, we've done it before, so we knew we could do it. It was a matter of just kind of getting hot. And, you know, they know that when you make a couple baskets and you make a run, there's two things that start to occur. It's you get your confidence, and that other team, the once the thought creeps into the mind of like, oh, holy shit, we can't blow a 24-point lead, suddenly they start to tighten up. And with Purdue, when you squeeze them, that's when Carson Edwards decides to start taking contested pull-up twos with a guy's hand right in his face and trying to make every play. And, you know, the hotter it gets for them, sometimes the worse he can get. You know, Purdue picked apart Michigan State yesterday by having this balanced attack, and then when it mattered most, it started to turn into hero ball time again, and that's when they came undone.
There was a lot of nervous energy in that building.
Oh my god!
On that bench, and I mean that was quite. It was quite clear to see on TV. Oh,
totally.
And Carson Edwards just jacking terrible shot after terrible shot.
Totally,
that was rough.
But then he also made an incredibly intelligent play on that corner three. He knew, you know, McQuaid gets his hands in there all the time and tries to deflect the ball or get it right in the guy's face. And Edwards knew it. He's been now dealing with McQuaid for two games of that kind of annoying hands-on defense. And he caught him. He caught a hand in there, drew a foul, buried all three free throws. And that was a huge turning point. McQuaid, after the game, admitted that he did get a piece. It was the right call. And just said, you know, that he regretted not getting his hand out of there in time.
He does that like once or twice a game, Edwards. Yeah. I swear, he did it. I think against Ohio State too. He's really good at that.
Mm-hmm.
As cheap as it may seem to be,
smart. If cheap is smart, then I'll
it worked.
Take
I needed it. It was about the only smart thing he did on offense. The whole
pretty
game.
Pretty much.
But what did you think about Michigan State intentionally fouling Nojel Eastern down the stretch?
I got it, especially the first one when they were in the 1-1
single bonus
for sure. I thought their defense was playing well enough that it would just be worthwhile just to play it out. And I thought, frankly, Purdue was playing poorly enough that it made just as much sense to let them try to actually generate a look. But Tom did make an interesting point at the end of the game where he worried that they were just done, that they were too gassed to defend. If that was the thinking in real time, I don't know. Or if he just kind of said that at the end, that could also be the case. But if he thought their legs were done, you know, it's a reasonable thing. But like, look, if Nojel goes 3 for 5 or 6 there, it looks genius. And he's a guy who is shooting 45% from the foul line. So why, if it's such a good idea to do it against a guy like Ethan Happ, why wouldn't it be a good idea to do it with him? Now, to do it with 2.5 minutes left in a 4-point game, that's a good question, but you know, I would put him on the line. I really have no problem with it. It just didn't work, and you know,
I always like to point out when people don't foul Xavier Simpson intentionally in a similar situation. But I think the single bonus versus double bonus makes a huge difference, especially after it doesn't work once.
Right.
I feel like going with that approach 3 times in a row is just. It sort of just took all the momentum out of the game, and it turned it into.
The last time these teams played, he went 1 for 6 on the line. So you know, like that's in the back of their minds. But since then, he actually hasn't been.
He's been really good the last 4 games from the line.
Not,
I mean, limited sample, but he's only missed one. All right, like that's good enough. Not so. I don't know. I just have a hard time. It doesn't work once. You have the double bonus. The expected value of doing that
right
increases significantly by. Having the second free throw guaranteed.
And was the third one, was that just a foul to stop the clock, or was it still the hack and Nojel?
I don't remember exactly.
I think that was just a foul. The second one was definitely intentional when they were in the double bonus. Like, that's probably the questionable one. The first one I thought was obvious to do. It makes perfect sense.
And I don't buy it. So they're tired, but they just came back from down 20 right. points, and they're playing with all the energy. I don't buy into that.
That's
in
fair. That's fair. I'm just telling you what he said, you know?
Yeah, I don't
on
buy
the
it.
Scene. The on-the-scene report. All right.
I'm sure I don't disagree that he said it. I just don't agree with the thought process. I also have a hard time seeing that. I've never heard someone say we're going to intentionally foul to catch our breath. Like,
yeah.
I've never heard that as a reason for intentionally fouling. But at least they did it when he had the ball. So that's progress from
Good point.
The other side of this podcast, intentionally fouling.
In the coach of the year conversation, this can come back up later on.
Yeah.
All right. So with Michigan State, I want to talk about Nick Ward here for a second. I think I would like your thoughts on the looks that he's getting right now, what they're trying to do with him. He, as more and more teams are doubling him, which is to be expected, and I just feel like he, as he's getting doubled or just trying to get his hands on the ball, he is getting farther and farther away from the basket. They've got 5 days here before returning to the court, and if there's anything that you can look at, I think Michigan State needs to look at, it's not only its screening actions offensively in the half-court offense, but I think they need to use this week to kind of rededicate parts of their half-court offense to getting Ward good, deep post-touches where he's at his most efficient. Like, because it's not only his scoring is down, but he's only taken 12 free throw attempts in the last five games combined. That's after he took 14 against Ohio State, you know, 2 weeks ago or so. Now he was banging with Caleb Weston in that game, blah, blah, blah. But you know what I mean. Like, a guy like Nick Ward should be getting to the line six, seven, eight, nine times a game and getting touches around the hoop.
A big, like, 50% of Ward's game comes in the first, like, 8 seconds of the shot clock where mm-hmm. he's going to beat his guy down and seal. And if you can take that away, you're going to cut his production down, right? And a good defense is going to be able to do that. The other thing about Purdue
but a good offense counters it, too.
Yeah, if you can score, you can't give those baskets up as often. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. The other thing about Purdue, they've basically turned their defense around by just going balls out and forcing turnovers and over-pressuring and using kind of some length to create turnovers, and that sort of saved their defense. They're still, like, second to last in the Big Ten in effective field goal percentage mm-hmm. defense, but they're forcing turnovers on 23-24% of possessions. That's not the kind of defense that Nick Ward wants to go against.
Right.
Because they're used to trapping, being active, and they are able to force – he had three turnovers, four made shots, right? I mean, so I think it's a tough matchup in a lot mm-hmm. of ways. And I think that by taking away the transition game, which Purdue did a great job of for most of the night, that takes away – a lot of Nick Ward's production. I mean, he had one of his finishes in transition during that game was just ridiculous.
Right.
He caught the ball running full speed and like right. managed to like somehow slow down and just right. toss it up. I mean, he's amazing in those situations, but you can't – I wouldn't say it's a staple to hammer the ball into the post unless the other team really has kind of a slow, lumbering big man too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The bigger question for me is – this was probably the first time you looked and you said, where's Joshua Langford? Because they needed someone to do something. And definitely. Matt McQuaid, Aaron Henry were not really ready to create their own shot from the wing.
So is this the end of that conversation that I keep hearing popping up left and right of whether this team is better without Langford than with it? Because that has definitely been a thing for the last week or two.
I think that they're... I think that the reasons that conversation was a thing are valid and that it maybe made Michigan State more pure to the things that work best, but you can see that it would be nice to have another option. I don't know. I also think if Matt McQuaid and Gabe Brown go 5 of 10 from 3 instead of 2 of 10, maybe it's a different game, right? I mean, a lot of these big Michigan State wins over the last couple weeks, like at Iowa, they hit all their threes in the second half, basically.
Right.
Right. I mean, I don't know. Aaron Henry's interesting to me because he shows all this talent, and he clearly has it, but he's not quite mature enough as an offensive player to count on in the half court. He's not consistent from three, and he is basically going to dribble as hard as he can and just try to dunk on you at the rim, totally. And that's like his offense. Not a lot of...
yeah.
middle ground there. So,
and in, I'll tell you what, though, in fairness, if you replay that game in your mind a little bit, at the what point in the game was that? Hold on 1 second.
The baseline dunk.
If he converts that, there was 9:14 left. They were on an 11-0 run. That would have made it a 13-0 run. You know, you could make you know, that their run kept on going. They got it up to 17-2 or whatever. But man, if he puts that thing down, you know, and everything goes out the same way it did, that would have, they would have gotten it down to a 2-point lead instead of a 4-point lead, and who knows from there. But
you would have been on SportsCenter too.
Yeah, I mean, that was a monster take.
So I think that just finding that other option is, and I get Langford could be it, but also I think Langford makes them less efficient in a lot of ways because he's not the most efficient offensive player. I'm fascinated by this Kenny Goins thing going on right now. He's slowly but surely, he's making more and more threes.
Uh-huh.
Teams are leaving him, but that's going to be interesting to see kind of how his three-point shooting tracks, because if he can hit 40%, teams are going to have to start guarding him out there. And right now they're just leaving that shot wide open.
Yeah, he is, let's see, 8 for 30 in conference play. I mean, it's not great, but
he's made at least one in the last six games.
I prefer him towing the line and putting that up versus Xavier Tillman. Because
Tillman made one?
Some of these, you know, like, just because he's made one or two, you know, some people seem to be okay with that being a shot. He's not a three-point shooter. Like, I understand that he can make it, but, like, Nick Ward can make it. That doesn't mean he takes them, right? It's only
Ward doesn't miss.
He's 3 for 3 in his career, yeah. But, like, those are only coming in desperation opportunities. Like, that's not part of his game because he's not a three-point shooter. Xavier Tillman, God bless him, good. He's a great player. He's shooting, like, 70% on twos this year. Just do that. He's not a three-point shooter. He's 1 for 12 in conference play. He's missed 5, 7. His last 10, dating back to the Ohio State game. Like, that needs to leave the offense. If it's late in the shot clock, he can put it up. But if he's shooting a three with 20 seconds left in the shot clock, it's a bad shot. I don't even care if it goes in. It's a bad shot. There's my hot take on Xavier Tillman's three-point shooting.
Fair enough. I'm going to say, back to your Nick Ward conversation.
Yeah.
He is going to just... If you have like a fantasy team or daily fantasy, just take him on Saturday and he's just going to score all the points against Indiana. That's going to be just no match. He's going to dominate the glass, score. He's going to score inside over Juwan Morgan all game. Write it down. That's his bounce back game right there.
I mean, they don't really have anything to counter what he is.
Clifton Moore? Oh, wait. No, not really.
Any other takes off of this game?
No, those are my big things. I'll be interested to see. I think it comes down to how sustainable. Michigan State still has the best. Teams are shooting 27% from three against Michigan State in the Big Ten. And they're shooting the fifth most threes.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happens with that number will kind of determine if Michigan State gets upset at all here coming up, because they allow so much volume. I don't know if you can. We'll see how sustainable that is.
Here's the question: what's Michigan State's next loss?
At Wisconsin.
At Wisconsin. Okay.
You?
Yeah, that sounds right. The only game that would worry me. I don't know. We're going to talk about Illinois later, but I know they're not that good. I know their record is what it is. But I would say if you polled most of the coaches in the league and said, which team over the back half of the year from the bottom half of the standings do you not want to play? I feel like a lot of them would say Illinois. But we'll talk about them later. But I would Wisconsin sounds right to me. If they can make it to the Michigan game on February 24th without losing again, then, you know, the league will basically might be wrapped up by that point. But that would entail them winning 6 straight games, and that would put them at 15-1. So, yeah, for the good of the league, it might be good if they fall here or there. But they're certainly capable of making that run. Part of the big question will be if and when Langford gets back and what the status of Kyle Larnes is.
One final question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that Big Ten winning streaks should include postseason Big Ten games? What's your take on this stat?
Oh, I guess God. It's over People now. Got salty as shit. So
it's just the
Michigan State making the claim of 20 straight Big Ten wins, except for the fact that they lost. Well, did they? They didn't count their conference tournament wins.
Yeah, the conference tournament didn't count.
Right. So if they counted the wins from the conference tournament, then yes, you would say that's nonsense. But you can say it's a 20 game regular season winning streak. Yeah, it might be a stretch, but still impressive. The more impressive thing was that they won 12 straight conference road wins. That was the more impressive thing.
That is impressive. I'm not saying it's not impressive. I just find it to be an odd stat. But we can move on. Do we want to talk about Michigan State, Indiana at all?
That game's so far away.
It's too far away. We can't think that far in the future here.
And I think they're going to absolutely dump truck them anyway. So, game is in East Lansing. Indiana is god awful, and I'm more. I wonder first if Indiana loses at Rutgers on Wednesday. Because if they lose at Rutgers on Wednesday, it's not. They're going to be rolling a corpse into Breslin next Saturday for ESPN game day.
Oh, what do you
think
of,
what do you think about that?
About what?
After all the stuff last year, after all the animosity toward from ESPN to Michigan State and Michigan State to ESPN and all the back and forth, lo and behold, when the invite was put out from ESPN to do game day at Michigan State,
money's still green.
The doors are open. I agree. Money's still green, and recruiting is still the most important thing in the sport. So you got to get exposure, especially when the perception at Michigan State is that a program like Duke is essentially an ongoing commercial product for ESPN. So I just found it really interesting. I definitely raised an eye. I didn't like make a big deal out of it on Twitter, but you know, there is a lot of people that have major, major issues with ESPN. In that athletic department, and you know, it wasn't a coincidence. If you noticed how they announced it, it was a video of Tom Izzo saying, you know, we're welcoming ESPN and make sure you come out and show your Spartan spirit and blah 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 blah. That's not accidental messaging, you know. If Tom can say that, then I think the thought is then everyone should kind of be on board with it.
Indiana at Michigan State for game. I mean, that's not even a good game.
Yeah, I don't know what.
That's the problem with college game day in basketball. There's got to be something there. I mean, no, it's not about Michigan State. It's just Indiana. I mean, that's a rough draw, right?
Totally. And when you look at the games later in the year, like, you could book either the Michigan State games. And
well, are they on?
They might be like going up against Duke, Carolina, or something. For all I know, but
yeah, and they're not going to the game in Ann Arbor is a CBS game, I would think, right?
That's a good point.
So it has to be a game that's already on ESPN. And I would assume that, yeah, the last game of the year is probably Duke Carolina.
Next Saturday's notable games are Duke St. John's, Virginia Tech, NC State, North Carolina Louisville. That's certainly better. That's at the Yum Center. That might not be an ESPN game. Yeah, that is an ESPN game. This is weird.
Kentucky, Florida,
Mississippi State, Ole Miss. That's a SEC Network game.
Texas Tech, Kansas.
Texas Tech, Kansas.
That's CBS. People don't need to hear us rattle off the entire schedule though. For
you sure?
Saturday's games. Let's talk a little Michigan. what you were in Assembly Hall?
Yes.
What did you think of that start to the game, from the shot clock to
the real story wasn't the 17-0, it was the clock. That was unbelievably advantageous for Michigan. It just sucked all the air out of the building. That place was hopping, ready to go. The students were good and boozed up and falling out of their chairs, you know, bloodthirsty. And then it just died immediately. And then Michigan came out, hit a couple buckets, air left. People were yelling, we suck, 4 minutes into the game. It was over. For like a program like Indiana that, right, you know, they're reeling and they need as much positive momentum as they can get to just have their balloon deflated 30 seconds into the game was just killer. Now, how much does that actually equate to the horrific start? I don't know.
Playing but without it a shot clock.
Oh, yeah, real, it's killer.
It seems like it should be a real issue. Right. Especially, I thought Beilein made a good point after the game that Michigan could still see the other shot clock when they are on defense.
Right.
It's not just that both teams are blind. I'm surprised that they didn't throw more of a fit. Like, when you think it would be a lot more fair to play with no shot clocks?
You would think, but, like, here's the problem. It's Indiana's home gym. You know, if that was happening on the road, they could throw a huge fit.
I guess that's true.
But it's your own clock. Like, what are you going to do? Like, you can't then tell the other team, like, you're playing without a shot clock, too. They'd be like, go to hell. This is your, it's your problem. It's your gym, you know? You can't, there'd be no basis for them to just say, we're turning off all of the clocks. Let's just turn off the game clock while we're at it.
Just seems more fair to me. I don't know. I feel like people would be, I think they got so badly outplayed that people probably forget about it, but
yeah.
I don't know. That was a bad break, and they fixed it in the second half, right?
Right, just in time for Michigan to shoot on that basket.
Although they kept yelling out 15, which was really confusing me because the shot clocks were on.
So we sit so far up we can't even see the shot clock at Assembly Hall from where the media seating is, and I assumed throughout the second half that the clock was not working as well because they kept announcing the time on the possession. And then only found out after the game that that clock was on the entire time. So that was a bizarre situation all the way around.
The PA guy didn't get new instructions. But Michigan, it was sort of a throwback to how they played early in the year where they just completely suffocated a team defensively to start the game, and then it was just kind of over. You could even say the first game between these two teams was similar where they jumped out on them, and then it was kind of an even game for 30 minutes, but you'd already spotted a 20-point lead, basically.
You can go back another game, even to last year's game in Ann Arbor. It was the same exact thing.
I don't remember that game, but I'll take your word for it.
Take my word for it.
What do you make of... So, it was, I guess, the biggest takeaway for me in that game was that Brazdeikis got back on track.
Yeah.
He...
Don't tell him that.
No, do not tell him that he did, but he hadn't played well since December, so I think it says something. I also think it sort of speaks to how he scores, and he scores by teams playing bad ball screen defense. Indiana consistently helped off him, overhelped on the ball screen, and he basically had catch and drive, catch and shoot attempts that he hadn't really had in the last 2 weeks. I think there's a way to defend Michigan, and what Indiana did was not it. And I think that speaks to the fact that Indiana's a team that wants to defend ball screens the way it defends ball screens. And you know what I mean? Like, are you going to be reactive, or are you going to be like, this is what we do?
Right.
And I think right now their defense is kind of, this is what we do. Unfortunately, it doesn't really translate against Michigan.
Yeah. Do you think it'd be possible to get stats on Brazdeikis when he makes his first three versus when he doesn't?
Probably, and it certainly helps.
It changes everything. It changes his confidence. It changes how the defense has to play him. Because like the second he misses one or two, and you can sag, especially when they get him into like an ISO spot or out on the wing one on one, and you can sit back a little bit, it makes all the difference in the world. Because the second you have to close out on him or take a step out closer to him to defend,
he'll blow by you.
That's when he has all the power and he gets all the leverage, because he's at his best when he gets into an isolation out on top on, like, I think you have, there's some great examples of it in the piece that's now on UM Hoops of the buckets that he got. That's by Eric Shapiro, right?
Yep.
You know, that little like 1-4 action that they do where they can get him out top, or if they can isolate him as the lone man on the weak side and get him just kind of headlong on a guy, like that's when he's at his best, and that's when he can use all of his moves. He can go left and right. He can finish in a variety of ways. He can even hit that little short pull-up. Like, That's when he's at his best, but so much of it is dependent upon
making his first three.
Making his first three.
And you see when he misses his first three, his second, third, and fourth threes get like a little more hopeful and less confident. He
totally.
Was aiming those shots at Wisconsin. He was like, And once he makes one, he's just... And then those two he hit in the second half were big shot. As big of a shot can be in a game that only gets down to 9 points. But
totally.
If he misses those, you're talking about an Indiana run maybe to start that second half. And I think it does come down to that three, but I also just... You have to, I guess, I don't know. It all comes down to the three from Michigan, right? Like, they have a bunch of guys who aren't great three-point shooters, and your best bet is to hope to shoot threes and miss them.
Yeah.
How many great Michigan starts include a Charles Matthews three-pointer?
Right.
And you're sitting there, and you're like, what are you going to do?
Oh, they look completely different. How do you like that? Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, because even at the same time, while they did make some threes in this game, they still, for the third straight game, didn't hit 70 points.
Yeah, the offense was great through 10 minutes, and then it just completely flatlined over the...
Correct.
Because they also didn't make as many threes for a bit, and they just don't really have that extra gear offense. They haven't showed it in a while, at least I would say. And that is sort of the... I guess, limiting factor for this team right now as far as they have the best defense in the Big Ten, but they don't necessarily have the offensive firepower to win a shootout at any given time, especially on the road.
Conference-only offense. They're fifth in offensive efficiency. They're sixth in effective field goal percentage. Like, those aren't wowing numbers, especially for this program.
Yeah, I think I looked up a stat that it would be their worst conference offense since 2015 when they missed the tournament. Mm-hmm. I think that was the year. And that was just a terrible team. Yeah. Obviously, now this team's playing defense at a level that really no other team has in the conference. And I think there were some questions maybe about their defense at some point, but I think they've kind of got back on track there. They've been a lot more solid defensively than they were in sort of that weird December stretch and even early into the Big Ten.
Here's something I wanted to ask you about dating back to last week. So I asked Beilein about it after the, which game was it? The Minnesota game. He made a comment that, look, I mean, Michigan is not a transition team, right? It is not reliant on that. But at the same time, like, if you get a run out for a team that struggles sometimes to get easy baskets, like, they have guys who can run and finish at the other end. You know, Charles Matthews can do that. Jordan Poole can do that. Ignas Brazdeikis certainly can do that. He made a comment that they don't run hard. And some of those opportunities are probably left by the wayside because guys kind of jog down floor and are maybe, I don't know if it's, you might be able to, I would be curious your opinion. I don't know if it's just guys who are kind of get into the flow of, okay, we're going to, you know, kind of come out on the wings and maybe be more worried about positioning themselves for a three on the break or in the secondary break or whatever versus, like, get your ass down the court and try to get, you know, a cheap basket at the other rim. Like, that's something that this team should be trying to get probably a handful of times per game just to get those easy buckets. What do you think?
Yeah, because Michigan has never been a volume transition team, but they've been a lethally efficient transition offense. That's been a huge part of their attack. And I used to, just thinking back, like, coaches would always talk about how important it is to stop Michigan's transition offense, like they're Michigan State or something. But it's different. It's just that they run for threes and they run really effectively. So, like, last year, they're – were rated in the 96th percentile in transition offense.
Mm-hmm.
This year, 55th.
Wow.
And that really, and it's about the same volume, but that really speaks to just they're not running as effectively.
Right.
And I'm sure that's the number that Milan's looking at. Like, we got to get some easy buckets here because, but last year you're running and you're running into a Duncan Robinson three.
Mm-hmm.
What are you running into this year? Jordan Poole, how many transition threes has he even attempted this year? You can't, like, you don't think of him busting his ass to the corner and getting open for threes. I think that is a very valid point, and it's something that they need to find some sort of momentum with, because I don't know that the half-court offense really has the ceiling, right?
And here's what you would say. In theory, you would think that last year, that this year's team is better, has better finishers or better or more athletic guys going to the basket, right? So you would think it would be inverted here, this conversation. The difference that I think exists is that a guy like Mo Wagner, his first three steps down the other to the other side of the court were full tilt every single time because he wanted a bucket, right? Mm-hmm. And Muhammad Ali Abdul-Rahman, his first three steps running down the opposite end were all out every single time. And I don't, that's what you're not seeing here. And I think that's what's starting to really annoy Beeline, is that you see some guys and they turn and run and they don't turn and sprint. Like, not to call a guy, you know, whatever, but like Jordan Poole kind of just turns and goes, right? He is not putting his head down, and there are so many guys who turn and look for the ball while running down the other side of the court instead of turning their head, going north and south, and hauling down to the other side of the floor and then looking for a ball. You know, that's stuff that needs to change, and it's just a change in mindset because they're all more than capable of doing so.
Yeah, and I think it's really on the wings. So I think Iggy is a guy who does get downhill, sprint, and try to get something in transition because he's, like you say, wired to just go get a bucket. I think it comes down to Jordan Poole. And Charles Matthews even doesn't really always run the floor naturally, so to speak. So they need to find something there. Even Isaiah Livers has kind of had some weird misses in transition. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought of Simpson as a good transition point guard, but whatever reason, their transition offense just hasn't quite clicked. And that I think he specifically called out Poole, I think, when he was talking about that at one point. So I think that's the guy they're really looking for, and a guy who's kind of struggling offensively. And you could say right now, when Jordan Poole plays well offensively, Michigan plays well offensively, and he just kind of – there's no consistent middle ground with him. It's either 25 points on seven shots or 8 points on seven shots.
Yeah.
It seems like for a while it looked like – I mean, two podcasts ago we were probably saying, is he going to be all Big Ten player? He's putting up these big numbers. He's totally hitting tough shots, and now he's just kind of went off the grid for a week and a half.
Yeah, no, it's – you can see the games where Beeline thinks that he's engaged versus when he thinks he's disengaged. And he can really ride him on games where he's just not particularly thrilled with his level of – he's a different player when he's getting his, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that – he's a sophomore, and this is kind of what – you know, it's what you go through with a sophomore who's been put into an entirely different role. They need a strong finish to the season from Poole on both ends in pretty much everything that he does. It can't be just about him getting buckets. It has to be everything.
Yeah, that I would say is probably the big – like if they're going to take a run at winning the Big Ten, they need Jordan Poole to play a lot better than he's played over the last 2 weeks. And there's going to be some games that are not – just getting buckets, having fun, hooping out there. Mm-hmm. It's not really going to be fun to go play Wisconsin again or right. play some of these teams, right? It's just right. like, it's one thing to go do it at home against Indiana and a full crowd and they're not playing good defense and you got McRoberts guarding you. Like, yeah, that's great.
Sure.
But what are you going to do when you got Davison all on you making your life hell? I mean, that's what they need him to have some of those kind of grinding games. Yeah. And I don't know that he's really doing that right now for them.
Definitely. On the bright side, people are probably sitting there thinking that we're being pretty critical of a team that's 19-1. But on the bright side, defensively, obviously, still an elite unit. And Charles Matthews, in that performance in Indiana, basically summed up everything that he means to this team as a guy who you can say, that's that team's best player, and you're going to go shut him down, and he can actually go and do it. And there are a handful of guys in college basketball who can do that at the level that he can, not only without fouling, but while also giving you, you know, some big buckets offensively. Charles Matthews is a guy who, for all the conversation that has gone on this season, from the early play of Brazdeikis to the emergence of Jordan Poole as a young star to Xavier Simpson and John Teske kind of becoming these, you know, expanded roles, their level of importance to the team, you know, kind of MVP players without being, you know, MVP type names, you know, all these storylines that have kind of coexisted throughout the year. All along, Charles Matthews has kind of just done his thing. And at times he's been the star, you know, but his consistency in just, I think, playing his game, and you want more out of him offensively so much, but what he gives him defensively, this game is kind of the summation of that, I think.
Yeah, his defense is sort of taken for granted, like you say, yes. Between Simpson, who just gets more headlines, and Teske, who's a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew's kind of been doing this for a year and a half now, and it's just easy to look at his offense. And the trouble I have with his offense is he had a stretch there in the second half where he kind of took over.
Yeah.
He was hitting jumpers. He made some free throws. He had some assists. Like, I think he had like 13 points in a row. He either scored or assisted for Michigan. Like,
yep.
He does that and you say, he should be a pro, right?
Right.
He should be able to do that all the time. But he also has moments where he looks like he's never jump stopped in the paint and finished at the basket when he's clearly more athletic than everyone else on the court. And
yeah.
It's the defense you can pretty much lock in, and I'd say for the rest of the year from him against any wing. I mean, I don't think you'd worry about Michigan there. The key for them is going to be figuring out how to sort of wind him up to a place where he's in an efficient role offensively in the NCAA tournament. Because that's what happened last year. And that was an underrated aspect of what changed for Michigan, was that he started playing efficient offensive basketball.
Totally.
At the most important time. And he does not generally play efficient offensive basketball in Big Ten games for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But he clearly has the tools. It's just, it has to be, you could watch clips of him, even like consecutive clips of him in games, and you would say, why isn't this guy the best player on the floor? And then you could watch clips of him and you would say, why is he playing 35 minutes a game?
Right.
So, I don't know. That's a... it's a really kind of back and forth there with that.
Like, what was interesting was there's two big shots he hit in the second half, the head-on three, and then he peeled off that screen and took that long pull-up too. When I talked to him in the locker room afterward, he's like, yeah, you know, like, I knew I needed to make shots because I didn't do it in Minnesota, and they were kind of looking at a guy who needed to do it, and I ended up hitting the game winner, but it was kind of an ironic game winner in that he has struggled to get his shots, and he made the game winner on a baseline floater that was as high as the shot clock. Like, yeah.
Yeah, he have,
for him to take those two long jumpers, he said afterward, he's like, eh, you know, the three was probably a good shot. He's like, but that long pull up too was probably a bad look. Like, that in our book is not a great shot. It's like he's still, at this point, after all these games at Michigan, is still trying to find out what is a good shot for him and what is not. It's really interesting.
Well, he also misses a lot of good shots, so maybe they're not so good shots. You know what I mean? Like, he, I don't know. I feel like sometimes he gets good shots that he doesn't make, and then he makes shots that you might say are bad shots, right? Like, he's not consistent with his, it's just all over the map with him. I don't know. Even still, you're talking about he's turned the ball over 15 times in the last five games. That's not a great look.
Yeah,
he is struggling offensively, but you still need him on the court. It's just such a weird dynamic from what he gets. And all the shots he made in that Indiana game were right after he got kicked in the back of the head. Like,
yeah, right, right.
Sometimes I feel like he just thinks way too much when he's playing offense. And he's just all instinct on defense.
Yeah, maybe that's probably a good question for Beilein. And he's supposed to have a press conference today. I'm not sure if it'll be canceled or not. But even after the Ohio State game, it's kind of like, it's probably around this time last year where he called him Bambi on ice. And a year later, I still don't know if they know what to do with him offensively. Which is kind of a fascinating situation, because you're right, they cannot afford to not play him. I mean, he played 35 minutes in that game. And what he did to Romeo was as important as anything that happened for anyone offensively in that game. You know, that was, you shut down Romeo on Indiana, you shut down Indiana, because they don't have pieces around him to make up for it. So you can just single-handedly beat them if you just stuff him in a closet. But he's an interesting player, and it's when he does take his matchups personally, he's a different guy, no doubt. Do we get into the Ohio State game now, or do you want to do it later?
We can talk a little Ohio State real quick.
Okay.
Finally, you've seen them in person.
I have a couple times. Yeah. Thought I liked them, then I thought I hated them. Now I think I might like them again. I'm not sure really what's going on. But after that 5-game losing streak that included an L at Rutgers, got back to some winning ways with a nice win at Nebraska, which is in a bit of a free fall here. I'm not sure what to make quite of Ohio State. 13-6 overall, 3-5 in the league. Probably not out of the NCAA tournament conversation.
I wouldn't say they're out of it, no.
Right?
The Rutgers L is not going to hold up real well, but I would say they're in the conversation. I think anyone's in the conversation in the Big Ten for a long time, because you just have to get a couple of upset wins, and all of a sudden your resume is going to look a lot better.
As of Saturday, Lenardi had them at 38 on the seed line.
There you go.
What was interesting to me about the Nebraska game, which I caught a bit of, was that Ohio State, which I think of as primarily a man-to-man team, they kind of changed the tide of the game a little bit by throwing a 2-3 at Nebraska that put them into some pretty weird spots. I asked Adam Jardy, who covers the Buckeyes for the Columbus Dispatch and does a great job. He kind of characterized it as saying the zone is pretty new. They briefly threw it at Purdue. It's something that they've been working on, and something that you'll probably see more of with Kyle Young out of the lineup. So
the things you do when you lose 5 games in a row.
Right. I mean, you got to change something up, and you know, everyone is obviously all constantly over the moon about how good of a coach Chris Holtmann is. Like, they're not just going to sit there and continue to do what's not working. So he'll switch it up.
But yeah, 43 possessions of zone defense this year. So
that's it. Okay.
Very new.
Do you know how many they played in the other game, in that game?
I don't have the count for, but I can tell you how many they played. Give me a second. At the game this weekend.
Well, it's, while you look that up, I'll say it was very effective in that game, and I think it could be effective against Michigan. Especially like we keep talking about, you know, them as a shooting team. If they're missing, you know, that's when you can take a pretty decent run at Michigan. So if they're changing defenses and they're flipping back and forth to this 2-3, it could just be an interesting spot for Michigan's offense to respond to. At the same time, they could pick it apart and end up finding stuff in the middle of the court against a team that probably hasn't practiced that much zone, right? I'd be a little bit worried about it if you're pretty green at it and you're going against a John Beilein coach team. That could also really blow up in your face. But it's certainly something to watch for, I think, in this game.
Yeah, I think you worry more about zone. Like, I think the most effective zones are those kind of tricky matchup zones that teams play a lot of and are a little, like, I don't know if just throwing out a 2-3 zone is going to sink Michigan's offense, especially at home.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the one other thing I would add is that they have basically made like a formal appeal to the league office. Did you see this about how Caleb Wesson is being officiated? So that's something to keep an eye on with the whistles on Tuesday night.
What's wrong with how he's being officiated?
He gets called for fouls every time down the court.
Is he fouling guys?
I mean, I would assume he's fouling guys if they're calling fouls, but he's basically over the last... So since December 18th, 4-4-4-5-4-4-3-5-4 fouls on Caleb Wesson. So he's basically almost – and he's rarely playing even 30 minutes a game. So foul trouble has been a big issue for him. John Teske does a great job of not fouling, but both teams can't really afford to lose either of those guys on the court. So that is an interesting thing to track. Weston's being called for 6.7 fouls per 40 minutes in the Big Ten, but he draws 6.8. So he just kind of gets in these brawls down there that you want to try to avoid. That's probably the most important thing for my money to watch early in this one.
I mean, the thing is, like, if you're going to be the one that initiates contact, you're going to be the one that's going to draw more fouls. And Caleb Weston initiates contact on both ends of the court every time down. So
let me look up the quote from Chris Holtman. I saw it on Twitter. I didn't read the whole article. I'm going to look it up real quick. But that is the key. So he told the powers that be. Chris Holtman said he talked to the powers that be in the Big Ten about the way Weston has been officiated the past three games in which he's been called for 13 fouls in 78 minutes.
Okay, so he put a call in
to the league office to
Rick Boyegis, and who's the league director of officiating, and said, voiced a complaint, and Rick probably will send an email to all of the league's officials, maybe making note of it. Does he go to the trouble of actually like putting together a film clip of the fouls that are being called on him? I can't imagine it reaches that level, but
are they actually bad calls?
That would be my question.
If you were an official and you got an email from your boss, mm-hmm. would you be prone to call more or less fouls on said player?
Depends on what the email says.
Depends on what the email says. Fair enough. So that's something to keep an eye on. I think we've hit on this a lot with Ohio State in the past, but their guards are super inconsistent scoring-wise.
Totally.
Luther Muhammad hit a bunch of shots at Nebraska, which won him the game, but he also has games where he doesn't really hit any shots. That's something to watch. I think that that's a – I don't know that Ohio State has the firepower to win in Ann Arbor.
I wouldn't think so. But those 9 o'clock games are weird. It'll probably be like half empty, I think, right? We're supposed to get all this snow. It's going to be like minus 10 degrees out. There were some empty seats for the last game when there was some weather issues.
It's also Ohio State, not Minnesota.
Do people care about Ohio State basketball this year?
More than Minnesota basketball.
I suppose that's a fair point. I don't know. I would agree with you. I don't really foresee them this being a loss for Michigan. But
could be
would you say Michigan's playing well right now? It seems like a ridiculous question to ask about the fifth ranked team in the country that's 19-1 and a half game out of first place in maybe the best league in America. But do you think they're playing well right now?
I think you're always playing as well as your last game, and I think
it's fair.
Going and winning by 23 points at IU there's a lot of negative energy, I think, kind of floating after that Wisconsin-Minnesota game. I mean, I think they're kind of in their heads, a little frustrated. It was the first time they really had to go through that. I think you start feeling yourself again when you go into Assembly Hall and just dominate a team, as bad as Indiana's been. I think that kind of gets you more on the right track. I don't think they're not playing their best all year by any means, but that Minnesota game, you could tell they were kind of working through some things. After the game, Friday was basically like, I was stupid to think we could just fix all of our issues with one practice after the Wisconsin game. And I think I don't think they're fully there yet, but I think a little bit of getting back to where they want to be, I would say.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you, your comment on Ohio State's guards, like if they can actually pull off a win. Really, the only guy, like, I think all of their guards are shooting under 40% from the field, not three-point line, from the field. In the six games of league play since the turn of the calendar, you know, CJ Jackson's at 37%, Dwayne Washington's at 35%, Luther Muhammad's at 39%, like those guys got to make shots.
Shoot a lot of threes. And it's just kind of a lottery if they go in.
Right. So it's not a coincidence that they are 1-5 in this stretch since January, since the beginning of January. So that's pretty much what it's going to ride on. And if you look at the numbers from the win over Nebraska, Luther Muhammad goes 3-for-4. C.J. Jackson goes 2-for-6 on threes. Musa Diallo hit 1-of-2. They went 9-for, they made 9. They still took 27. Good Lord. But
yeah, they shoot over 40% of their shots from three. So that's, Michigan obviously tries to prevent as few, many three-point attempts as possible. So that's kind of an interesting battle. Can Michigan take those threes away without doubling Caleb Wesson? Or do they have to double Caleb Wesson and maybe give up some of those threes?
I would not double Caleb Wesson. I don't think you need to with Teske. And they do like to flash him out, and he can hit a pick-pop three. Can he, you know, if Michigan doesn't switch, does he actually put them up over Teske? I don't know about that. But how many has he hit this year so far?
He's 13 of 39. And here's my thing. If he makes an early one, I would 100% leave him after that, because he's going to give you at least two possessions back by chucking up a few more. I feel like he did that in the Michigan State game, where once he makes one, he just starts thinking like, all right, I'm just a shooter now.
Well, he only took two against Michigan State. He made one.
The second one was an awful shot.
Well, the first one he made was equally huge. It was at the end of the first half, and Ohio State was rolling. And it was a big, big shot. But the point is, you have to respect it a little bit. But yeah, I haven't seen enough of them. Or the interesting thing, like when you talk about Michigan playing defense, is that Teske is such a unique guy in the league. Like my question on Caleb Wesson would be like, how does he play over length, right? How does he play against a true 7-footer? You're only going to see a handful of them, right? Harms. Teske, I don't even know who else I'm missing, but how many true 7-foot centers are there? It's just a totally different look. But like Wesson, for as big as he is pretty quick, but like just Teske never plays himself out of position. So I would certainly start off 1-on-1, because the second you double him, now you're in rotation, and I just don't see Ohio State beating them straight up defensively.
No, I get that. And I think Michigan's offense at home gets kind of back on track against a team that plays a slow big man. That's not a great setup for your ball screen coverages.
Yeah.
But you got to make shots, so we'll see with that. Do you want to get into the
We're an hour into power this rankings? Thing.
Anything left over? We might as well get into it quick.
Yeah, all right. Power rankings. I had first pick this week. This might be controversial. Because of the loss and because of the Twitter mentions, but I am putting Michigan State still in the number one spot. Before anyone starts yelling their radios, I am basing this off of efficiency numbers, Michigan State having more road wins, and Michigan State being in actual first place in the Big Ten. So
in playing a tougher schedule.
Playing a tougher schedule and having played better of late. So we'll stick with the Spartans in the number one spot for now. Do you agree?
Yeah, I agree. I think that you look at the league games they've played, the league games they have to play, and then you look at the same for Michigan, and then you say they've won those games by more points per possession. It's kind of hard to make the case for Michigan in the league. I guess people would probably say, well, Michigan State's lost three games over the whole season, but whatever we're talking about right now. And I think that's probably the situation in the Big Ten right now. As far as Michigan, obviously they're kind of a lock for number two. We can kind of brush over that, I would say.
I had three. Let's see. I think I took Purdue. I would imagine I took Purdue.
You did.
I did take Purdue. Really, you know, it was impressive stuff this weekend. And whether... You know, my big question is whether they can keep playing exactly the way they played that game and whether they can get contributions outside of Carson Edwards. I like the lineup with Travion Williams in a starting role. They look better, and they're playing defense, I mean, at a extremely higher level than they did at any point this year, especially when I saw them in person against Michigan in December and then against Michigan State in January. This looked like a different team. It had different energy defensively. On the offensive side, I think they cut harder and move harder and move smarter. So they are really they've really put themselves in a pretty impressive spot, because I basically was selling Purdue not very long ago. And as of right now, before the win over Michigan State, Lunardi had them as a 5 seed. They're probably that's a win that puts them probably up a line. So you're talking about a, you know, the conversation all year has been, man, you know, it's going to be Michigan and Michigan State as 1 or 2 seeds, and then like the next one will be like a 7 or something or a 6. Well, you know, Purdue might be able to walk its way into like a 3 seed, which would be pretty impressive considering what they lost off of last year's roster. It's been pretty impressive.
Yeah, I really like. I know everyone likes to talk about Travion Williams, but I really like what Aaron Wheeler is giving them. Mm-hmm. He kind of, the game at Michigan, I feel like, was one of the first times he kind of came in and made a few plays, and now he's kind of a staple of what they're doing.
Yeah.
Their defense, 4 games in a row under a point per possession. They probably had like 4 of those in the first 16 games. So they've really fixed their defense to an extent, and they've done it by, I think I said this earlier, but they forced turnovers. And Matt Painter's teams had really gone away from that over-aggressive turnover-forcing style of play. As they had like the big, slow, big guys in there the last few years. And this year they're kind of going back to that, which you think of with some of the older, like Chris Kramer teams back in the day that really did get after it and pressure on the perimeter and force turnovers.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So I think you look at their schedule on the back half and they become a really interesting team, because they've really had to battle through it with a tough schedule in November, December to now. Now they don't play Michigan, Michigan State, or Wisconsin again the rest of the year.
Yeah, pretty good.
And number 4, I've got Wisconsin. They are looking the part, and that win over Michigan kind of gave them some momentum. I think you think about that overtime game they had against Purdue. If that game goes the other way, you might be talking about Wisconsin as the team that is all of a sudden trending in the right direction and mm-hmm. is one of the top teams. I think they're pretty comfortably – I like them ahead of Maryland next, and I think they're just a solid defense. They're one of the 3 teams in the league that is really good defensively, and the rest of the league is pretty terrible defensively other than Michigan, Michigan State, and Wisconsin. Those are the only 3 teams holding Big Ten teams under a point per possession.
Yeah. Yeah, like as of now, I'm sticking with my pick of Wisconsin ultimately finishing 3rd in the league. I know that's hard to say with Purdue's schedule, and Wisconsin still has to go to Michigan, and they will play home against Michigan State. But I like their experience, and Happ is just doing a lot of amazing things. He had a triple-double this weekend against Northwestern. We'll see. They have an interesting game on the road at Nebraska on Tuesday. But what seed line do you think Wisconsin ultimately lands on in the tournament? Do you think they are 4 or 5, or do you think they're 6, 7?
I think that they will play their way into a top 5-ish seed.
Okay.
I think they're that good, and I think if you come in 3rd or 4th in the Big Ten, I think, like, if you're getting a double bye in the Big Ten tournament, I think you're going to have a pretty good seed. Mm-hmm. And I know they lost that Western Kentucky game, whatever. They lost a couple home games, but if they finish, like, right now, their KenPom projections 13-7.
Yeah.
If you go 13-7 in this league, you're going to be a top 5 seed, I'd say.
I would agree with that. All right. I'm on 5, right?
Yep.
Okay. We got Maryland at 5, which is probably to be expected here. Still a weird team, man. Like, how do you lose Illinois, who, you know, is dangerous, as I mentioned earlier, but going and playing on a neutral court, which, like, I imagine Maryland had more fans there because it's an East Coast thing, but to come off of a road loss at Michigan State and needing, you know, a good solid win over Illinois, and instead to lose by 11, kind of a slap, and you have to wonder how they're going to respond to this game. But you know, they shot let's see, shot 6 for 19 on threes and committed 21 turnovers. It was just a bad basketball game, and they kind of played right into what Illinois wanted them to do.
Yeah, it's one of those things we should have saw coming because they turned the ball over more than any team in the Big Ten, and Illinois forces more turnovers than any team in the Big Ten. Kind of a perfect matchup spot there. So and they don't play well into that style of play at all.
But it would be one thing if it were like 40 minutes of that, but they just collapsed at the end of the game. They were outscored 26-12 in the final 10 minutes of the game. You know, for a team that you think is kind of right on that line of are they going to prove themselves to be, you know, a real contender, not only in the league but nationally, you just expect, I think you expect more when it comes to winning a game in late January against the team that you're probably favored over by 8 or something.
One thing I was noticing is every team that's lost to Michigan State except for Purdue and Northwestern has lost at least its next game.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's just random, or, but I found it an interesting fact.
I think it's random.
All right, next I've got Iowa. And well, I guess we should note the top 5 teams are the only teams in the Big Ten that have a positive efficiency margin, and we're almost at the Big Ten midpoint. So at the rest of the league has all been outscored in conference games, and I took Iowa next. Iowa is – it's kind of hard to pick a team coming off of two just awful performances, and they are proving that they play the worst defense in the Big Ten yet again. They're giving up 112 points per 100 possessions in the league, which is ridiculously bad. But they also have the number 3 offense, so they just play shootouts on any given night. And I don't know that – it's just hard to pick someone else ahead of them. I know they lost at Minnesota, but that game's on the road, and Minnesota's in a bounce-back spot.
Iowa so wonderfully sums up this league in a number of ways as a team that right now is probably like a 6th seed in the NCAA tournament. And its fans probably want Fran fired after this past week. People are losing their minds out there because they're just maddening at sometimes. Like, to give up a 24-4 run on your home court while your coach doesn't take a timeout is insane. And then to lose to Minnesota, giving up 92 points to a team that is flawed in a number of ways. They scored 59 at Michigan earlier in the same week. 57, sorry. Is pretty incredible. And then to still have a chance to win, and the best player on the team gets a rebound and decides to dribble the length of the floor into a double team, ignores someone who is wide open and has been making shots, Isaiah Moss, and then commits a turnover. I was at the airport bar watching it in Indianapolis. Just people thought I was a crazy person because I was yelling about Iowa, Minnesota, alone at an airport bar eating a steak, but this is my life. So, yeah, Iowa is just, they wear the Big Ten patch proudly, my man.
It's a mess.
I got Minnesota. Six, I got 7th. Okay. Number 7, Minnesota. I have no idea what to make of them from week to week. Obviously, everyone and all old listeners of the pod know my very rocky relationship with the Gophers. But, you know, they almost pulled it off at Michigan. I give them a lot of respect for finishing that game strong and trying to steal one. It was, you know, 4 minutes left in the game. That game was over. Michigan was up by 12, and it looked like the only question was whether they were going to cover or not. It was a 13-point spread. Instead, Minnesota, frankly, scared the hell out of them. I mean, it got really uncomfortable at Chrysler Center late in that game. So, you know, respect for that. And then go and win at Iowa at a hard place to play at on a Sunday night, the dreaded Sunday night road game, which is miserable.
No, it was in Minneapolis.
It was in Minneapolis. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that game was at Minnesota. Okay. With the white court.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Your favorite court in the league.
I hate that.
But now, now it's, you know, Minnesota has Illinois on Wednesday at home. And would you in any way be surprised if they dropped that game?
Well, considering Illinois beat them by almost 30 a couple weeks ago.
Exactly.
No.
Exactly.
And that's the thing about Minnesota is that when they fall really, other than the Michigan, like they have a 20-point loss to Ohio State. They lost by 15 to Maryland. They fall really hard. and then they look good and they win some games, but man, when they fall apart, it's ugly. I've got Ohio State at 8. You can still make it to 8th place in the league even after you ride out a 5-game losing streak, but they did go win at Nebraska. I guess we can get to Nebraska soon, but big injury for Tim Miles down there. But Ohio State needed this win and bounces back. And I think, yeah, they're still in the bubble team talk, even though I don't really know that they're a great team. But it doesn't take much to kind of turn your season around when you have a chance for a quality win every other game or so.
Yeah, yeah. I agree, and we talked about them in the Michigan portion of the show. But so we'll move on to number 9. We got Nebraska. You know,
not good.
And Miles is trying to play more guys and find depth, but that depth is just not productive.
He's gonna have to now.
At all. Yeah, they lose Isaac Copeland, which is brutal for a team that has zero depth. He said prior to the Ohio State game that he was willing to take a deficit in points if it meant playing some different guys. That's quite a sorry-ass statement for a team that's supposed to be pretty good entering the
year. So Copeland played 15 minutes in that game, and only two guys off the bench played double-figure minutes. Right. So they
just don't have bodies. They just don't have bodies behind anyone. And they gave up some like horrific second chances to Ohio State in that game. Missed rebounds where there'd be one Ohio State player surrounded by three guys from Nebraska, and the guy from Ohio State came out with it. Just not making possible plays. They're in a bad spot, and I'm not sure what do they have coming up here. They have Wisconsin this week. You know, that could turn into a 4-game losing streak, and then they go to Illinois, and then they get Maryland at home, and then they go to Purdue. So there's a chance, I think, in the next 2 weeks that the Nebraska NCAA tournament conversation is officially over by February 9th.
Yeah, they're the worst defensive rebounding team in the league by about 6%. They give up 4%. They give up offensive rebounds on 36% of opponent misses. No one else in the Big Ten is worse than 32%.
Yeah.
So basically everyone else is a decent defensive rebounding team in the league, and then there's Nebraska.
Yeah. I just rattled off their upcoming schedule. Well, they finished the year with Purdue at home, at Michigan State, and then Iowa. So I just don't see how this is manageable. They'll finish under 500 in the league. And
end of the road for Tim Miles?
Might be the end of the road for Tim Miles.
Number 10, got Illinois. And it sounds crazy that they're all the way up here with only two wins. But the efficiency numbers say that they're probably better than their record. They've played a tough schedule. And they've had some impressive performances here over the last couple weeks for a team in this area. I'm really interested to see. I agree with you that I don't think anyone will want to really play them.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of miserable to play against. I think their offense is hard enough to prepare for in the sense that it's different than what you see on any given day.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just like your basic horn set that you're preparing for. It's this weird Brad Underwood offense. You have to put in a whole new prep for it. And their defense is just miserable to play against, even though they foul all the time and give up layups all the time. It's not fun.
Right.
So I think it's not a fun prep. I don't know that they're going to go crazy down the stretch, but I think they'll knock off a few teams that would expect to handle them comfortably.
I agree. They've got some real players. Trent Frazier can do a lot of good things, and Kipper Nichols can do some things. And then you got this Tavian Jones who comes off the bench, puts up 18 this weekend, who was a guy who was pretty much off people's radars at this point, but he's a former top 150 kid. He's a freshman, 6'7 guy. He can play. And, you know, for all the talk of the freshmen, your Romeos and your Ignis Brazdeikis, Ayo Dosunmu. Ayo Dosunmu, who's only the second hardest name to pronounce on the team, but Ayo is a legit dude, and I really like Georgie. And here's my attempt at this one. Bishan Ishvili. Bishanishvili. I nailed it. That's the my
Illini expert right here.
Bishanishvili. Pretty good for an Irish guy, right?
That's pretty good.
So, but I love what he brings, man. Like, he gives him great energy. He's all over the floor. Gets his hands on the ball. He's a pest. He's a guy who people better learn his name because he's going to annoy the shit out of everyone in this league for the next 4 years. Without
he's
a doubt.
He's funny, too.
He is funny. He's got a big personality. I saw him in the press conference after the Michigan game. He was great. He was sitting there saying, like, I play for my brother. It was very Mo Wagner. He was like, I play for my brothers, and they play for me, and I have their backs. And I think Ayo was sitting next to him kind of looking at him like, all right, bro, let's settle down. Let's settle down. But, you know, no, they are a dangerous team. They're going to pick some people off. This week they have Minnesota on the road and Nebraska at home.
All right, let's run quick hitters through the rest of these. You got Northwestern next.
Yeah.
What do you – they Bart Torvik, I think, tweeted a stat that they were, I think, one of 21 or something like that on long twos against Wisconsin. That kind of says it all.
Wow. That's a lot of long twos to take.
That's what happens.
A lot of long twos.
Next up, we got Indiana, which is crazy that they're all the way down here at number 12. But that is life right now, and even their efficiency numbers, they've been outscored by 10.5 points per 100 possessions. That's really bad. That's worse than Northwestern. They're just, I don't know. They got to figure out something, and they're running out of time.
And they're coming off a game where the coach just straight blasted them in the post-game press conference, saying they're soft, saying they're bringing no energy, saying basically calling
out, scared.
Calling out their manhood, very much so. So this is a big week for the Hoosiers. It is not off the table that they lose at Rutgers.
No, that's who you got next. Tell us about why they're going to lose at Rutgers.
Rutgers plays hard. They play harder than Indiana. So
right now they're on a two-game winning streak,
and they're starting to smell themselves a little bit. You know, I think they're feeling pretty good. Maybe buying in. They're 3-6 in the league. I mean, how many other years can you say that this has to be their best start?
Have they ever had a Big Ten winning streak?
I'm looking at it right now. Certainly not under Pikel. No. This is their best start in program history, I think, in the Big Ten. Certainly better than the 2-16 campaign of 2015.
Will the Rack be jumping on Wednesday night?
The Rack might be hopping, man. Just bring it. Yeah, this is their best start in Big Ten history and their first two-game winning streak. So look out for the Scarlet Knights.
The buzz. And speaking of no buzz, we wrap up with Penn State at 0-9 in the league. And
coming off the home loss to Rutgers, by the way.
A miserable mess. I don't know what – I was watching all those games on Saturday, and I had to just turn it off when the Penn State-Rutgers game. I couldn't even get through it. It was just – they just can't score. I don't know how it gets better for Penn State either. Last year was the year they really needed to make the NCAA tournament. It didn't happen, and where's this thing going? I don't know.
It's a Division I team that doesn't have a single guy shooting over 36% on threes. I mean, that's incredible. So, yeah. I did watch the game versus Rutgers at a B-Dubs in West Lafayette. It was one of the low points of my life. I don't really want to talk about it, but
dedicated to the grind.
Here we are. My hotel didn't have BTN. How's that possible? Brutal.
They're trying to look out for you.
I know, man. All right. Well, that'll do it for this week's show. It was a doozy, checking in at an hour and 22 minutes. If anyone actually made it to the end, you should certainly at least hit subscribe and probably leave a review and a rating. And go check out umhoops.com. There's some great stuff on there from the Indiana game, including, like I said, that video breakdown of Brazdeikis. And as always, Dylan's five takeaways from the game are on point. And then make sure you check out The Athletic, our national coverage, as well as our Detroit coverage. Subscribe to that too. Just spread out all the money. And if you're in the giving mood, check out an article from the Detroit Free Press this weekend on Mumford High School Wrestling and my man Pete Cunningham, who is the head coach there for the only public wrestling team, public school wrestling team in the city of Detroit. Pete's an old colleague and one of the finest people you ever meet. And there's a link to a GoFundMe page for that program. And if you want to like give a couple bucks that actually go to something, that's pretty awesome. I give full endorsement to the work that Pete's doing at Mumford. So that'll do it for this week's show. You got anything to say for yourself, Dylan?
We're going to have to start giving our plugs at the
beginning. That would probably be more
No one's getting this far. It's not good for business. We're going to have to flip that around.
Or we just test your editing skills and you just cut this out and you just put it at the beginning. You just do that.
That's not going to work.
Does that not work?
The audio technician is limited in his abilities in this podcast production. As people that listen every week probably can tell.
No. To hell with you. Pick up your game. All right. That'll do it for this week. Be sure to tip your bartenders and your servers, folks.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.